If you were fascinated by Greek and Roman gods and the myths that surround them as a child, you might be surprised to discover the details that were left out of those stories. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Sanitized versions of Greek and Roman myths have supplied subject matter for many books for children. The unsanitized, unvarnished versions of those myths have primarily been the territory of classical scholars. Philip Freeman, chair of the Classics Department at Luther College, has now made these original stories accessible to all of us in his new book, Oh My Gods, a Modern Retelling of Greek and Roman Myths. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. The Greek myths you learned as a child about noble Zeus and the other gods and goddesses on Mount Olympus and in the underworld were sanitized for your consumption. For centuries, the actual stories told with all of the gory details have been the domain of classical scholars. But now my guest, Philip Freeman, the chair of the Classics Department at Luther College in Decorah, is making them accessible for all. His latest book is Oh My Gods, a Modern Retelling of Greek and Roman Myths. And before we get into these stories, I do want to mention, I know this is a holiday for most people. A lot of kids are home from school. These stories contain a number of adult themes. They may not be appropriate for the younger listeners in your home. But Philip, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
As a classics professor, you've been teaching these stories. You've been talking about the ancient mythology for years in your classroom. What made you think that you needed to bring it outside the classroom and make it something that somebody who never thought of taking a classics lecture would read?
Well, sometimes I will give talks about classical mythology to adults in libraries and in parent days and things like that. And they always have people come up to me afterwards and say, are there any books available for grown-ups about classical mythology? And I say, well, there are a few out there, but they're mostly academic sort of books. And people say, gosh, I wish somebody would write one for me. And so I wrote this book about classical mythology and tried to include all of, like you said, the gory details and such in it. So I thought there was a need.
So in searching out these stories, obviously you were familiar with them, but to write a book about them, you wanted to get all of the details right. Where did you go? What kind of texts did you look to find the stories?
Well, back to the original sources, back to the ancient Greek tales by Homer and Hesiod and Aeschylus and Sophocles and Euripides and all those other guys. So I went back to the original documents, and there are an awful lot of them.
I'm sure. And how did you decide what you would include?
Well, I knew I had to include the major stories, such as the Trojan War, the voyage of Odysseus, the creation of the world, some of the basic stories about the individual gods. So it was a bit random in some ways. I left out an awful lot of stuff. I could easily do another book just with the myths that I didn't include. But I wanted to give a representation of what these stories are. Most people know a few of them, but I wanted to really give them a widespread of these different stories.
Where do these stories come from? I mean, you talked about the texts that you went back to, but do we know who invented these stories?
We don't really. They've been around for thousands of years. And we know going back to what they call Mycenaean Greek times, which is 1200 BC and before, that these stories were being told then. So they were told around the campfire, told around the hearth on a cold winter's night. So these are oral stories that were eventually recorded by Greek and Roman writers.
And of course, I'm sure they morphed along the way. So when you went and looked at these sources, you must have found several different versions of one story in some cases.
Yes, that's kind of the problem, is you get five or six different versions of a particular story, and you have to choose if you're writing a narrative like I did. And so I tried to pick the best one. Sometimes I would say things like, well, this other author says this, and so I'd try to give multiple versions. But most of the time, I just had to pick the one that best fit.
When you looked at the stories, the ones that we tend to be familiar with are sort of creation myths, like this thing happened and then this god did this and then suddenly you have the creation of spiders, for example. You know, this is where spiders came from. They're the kinds of myths that explain something that we encounter in our everyday world. Those seems to be the ones that you know, you find in children's literature and that kind of thing. Did you find, are there other overarching themes that we may not suspect would be there?
Well, there are themes, the origin stories, what we call etiology in mythology, is an important theme, you're right. But there are certainly overarching themes, themes like love and death and suffering and friendship and fate that come up again and again in these stories.
Let's talk about creation, because the mythology from ancient Greece that surrounds creation makes the creation myths that we hear, the creation beliefs that people have in modern society, the creation stories that are told, seem incredibly simple. So when we look at Greek creation stories, try to give me an overview. What happened?
Well, the first words of the book are, "In the beginning there was chaos," and that's exactly how it begins in the Greek stories. Back before anything was made, there was chaos, this great yawning chasm, out of which came the primordial elements of the earth, such as earth itself and Eros, or sex, plus a number of other gods. And then these gods mated with each other and gave birth to other gods, fundamental forces of the world, most of them negative, like suffering, pain, death. And then things got really interesting when you get to the second generation of gods, with when earth and sky mate and create their own children.
Tell me about the relationship between earth and sky, because this was not a particularly happy union.
No, it wasn't. Earth gave birth to sky, but then sky became her mate. And every evening, sky would come down and lie on top of earth and mate with her. And earth bore children. And every time this happened, sky shoved the children back into earth. And so earth got more and more full of these children. It was very uncomfortable, and she was very angry about it. So she said to the children inside of her, "Won't somebody do something about your terrible father?" And so her youngest child, Cronos, said, "I'll do something, Mother." And so one night, just when Skye was coming to lie down on earth, Cronos reached up with a pruning hook and cut off his father's genitals and flung them across the earth and created giants and horrible monsters and all sorts of things. Yeah, that was, it's kind of a rough beginning.
And Cronos then and his siblings, these are the Titans.
Those are the Titans, yes.
And from the Titans came the gods.
From the Titans, the third generation of gods were the ones that we know about, Zeus and Poseidon and Demeter and the rest. Cronos mated with his sister, and she gave birth to all these other gods, Zeus and the rest.
And Cronos had been told that one of his sons would overtake him.
Right. Cronos had been told that one of his sons would overthrow him, and so he swallowed each of them when they were born, except for Zeus. His mother, Zeus's mother, said, "I'm going to fool Cronos." And so when she gave birth, she wrapped a big stone in a blanket and gave it to Cronos to swallow. And so Cronos swallowed it. And then Zeus went off and was raised in secret, waiting someday to overthrow his father.
And then what happened when he met his father?
Well, they got in a big war. And they fought, and the Titans versus the gods, this went
on
for years.
And he was able to release his siblings from
his
father?
He tricked his father into throwing up the rest of his siblings. They were all safe. They were gods. You can't kill a god even if you swallow it. There was a giant war.
It's not
war.
A good childhood, though.
No, my goodness. These gods have the roughest childhood. It's not at all happy.
So they grew up inside their father, and then once they were released, there was a war that went on for a very long time.
There was, and it was nasty and mean, and they brought in all sorts of monsters to fight on both sides until eventually Zeus and his siblings overcame Cronos and the rest of the Titans and threw them into prison down in Tartarus forever, hopefully.
And Zeus, obviously he was the one that released his siblings, but how did he become the head god, the most powerful?
Well, he was just by nature, I think, the most powerful. He was in charge of lightning. He was the god of the sky, but he was always worried. It had been foretold to him that somebody, his son of his, might overthrow him. And so he was always on guard, always watching. These other gods were unhappy themselves that Zeus was in charge. Poseidon and Hades, his brothers especially. And so they were always threatening revolution against Zeus.
And Poseidon, Zeus, and Hades are kind of the main three. They divided the world amongst themselves.
They were, exactly. Yeah, Zeus ruled the sky, Poseidon ruled the seas, and Hades ruled the underworld. The earth itself was sort of neutral territory.
And because they divided the world like that, it sounds like they were equal, but they were not equal.
No, not at all. No, Zeus was far more powerful than Poseidon or Hades, even though they were always trying to overthrow him. But it was an uneasy rule, very much.
Well, and one of the things that you find in many of these stories, and we'll hear it more and more as we go on, but there is a lot of intermarriage. There's a lot of incest in these stories. And just trying to sort out this third generation, this generation of gods, the Olympians, they're not all Cronos's children.
No, there are a bunch of other gods that get thrown in all over the place from different fathers. And so Zeus himself has children who become, like Apollo, who become part of the main Olympian gods. And so it is very confusing. I did a genealogies in the back of the book.
Pages and pages of them, yes.
Believe me, it gets confusing when you have brothers and sisters mating. I had to come up with all sorts of strange little diagrams to try to represent it.
Well, and even just trying to figure out, obviously Hera was Zeus's wife, which
right.
is, we'll talk more about their relationship after our break, but she was not his only wife.
Oh no, Zeus had, half a dozen other wives, plus a whole bunch of mortal women that he had children with. So no, it is a very complicated situation.
But Hera, was she his sister?
Yes.
All right,
oh, yes.
So Zeus married his sister.
Yes, a lot of the gods did marry their sisters, in those early generations especially.
I suppose there just weren't a lot of other goddesses around.
Yeah, not a lot of choices, yeah.
And what was Hera's power? What was her focus?
Well, Hera really was the goddess of women. She was in charge of issues about women from the cradle to the grave, about childbirth and mothering and marriage and old age. She was a goddess who was worshipped by women, naturally enough. And there are so many stories about her, just tantalizing little hints. But we don't have all that many myths about Hera, mostly just how she was always chasing after Zeus or chasing after the women that he slept with.
We'll find out more about the gods and goddesses from ancient Greece in a moment. My guest today is Philip Freeman. He is the head of the classics department at Luther College, and he has written a book to bring all of these myths out of the classroom into popular culture, or at least give us all an opportunity to find out more about the myths as they were originally told. His book is Oh My Gods, a Modern Retelling of Greek and Roman Myths, and you're welcome to join our conversation today. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest today is Philip Freeman. Today we're talking about the myths about ancient Greece and ancient Rome, the gods and goddesses who lived on Mount Olympus and in the underworld. These are stories that often get told to children in sort of a cleaned up way, a sanitized version of these stories, but we continue to be fascinated with them as we grow. And Philip Freeman has found that many of his students, many people that he talks to over the years, have wanted to know more about these stories. So he's gone back to the original sources and published these books or these stories in a new book called Oh My Gods, a Modern Retelling of Greek and Roman Myths. And as I mentioned before, these stories are not for children. So if you have younger listeners with you right now, you might want to bear that in mind. And before the break, we were talking a little bit about Zeus, who, of course, was the chief god, the most powerful god, and his wife, his sister, Hera. And she was the goddess of women and of marriage and of childbirth and all of these homely arts, I guess. She and Zeus did not have an ideal relationship. Tell me a little bit about their marriage.
Well, Hera was always chasing after Zeus because Zeus was a serial adulterer. And so Hera really was not stronger than Zeus, so she couldn't overthrow him or anything like that. But she was always angry at him. And so every time he would come home, Hera would yell at him. And then she couldn't go after Zeus, so she would go after his lovers, especially his mortal lovers.
Which seems remarkably unfair, because in the stories as you share them, these are not willing lovers of Zeus.
No, not at all.
Almost never.
Oh, no, almost never. You take women like Io or Europa, who are young maidens who want nothing to do with Zeus. But
well,
Zeus...
tell us about Io. That's a wonderful example.
Well, Io was a young maiden who lived in the land of Argos in southern Greece, and Zeus cast his eye upon her and decided he wanted her. So he would send her dreams at night and say, come and lie with me, my love, and we will all the pleasures prove, and things like that. And she kept saying no, 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 until eventually Zeus threatened her father to destroy her whole family. And so Io was set out in a field, and Zeus came down and he raped her, as he did so many of his victims. And Hera noticed something was going on, and so she swooped down from heaven. And just in time, Zeus turned Io into a cow to hide the fact. But it didn't fool Hera at all. And so Hera said to Zeus, oh, my dear, why don't you give me this nice cow to be my pet? And so Zeus said, sure, honey. And so he gave Hera the cow. And then Hera tormented this cow for years afterwards, sent a fly to sting her and all sorts of terrible things.
So and this happens again and again and again, where Zeus rapes a young woman, a beautiful young woman, often a young woman who has pledged to be a virgin forever.
Yes.
And she inevitably becomes pregnant. He's very virile.
Yeah, all the gods are. That's one thing. If you have sex with a god, you can bet you're going to get pregnant.
Right. And then Hera would torture this young woman.
Yeah, absolutely unfair. And nobody ever said the gods were nice. The Greek and Roman gods were mean and petty and vindictive, and they could occasionally be kind, but it was almost as an afterthought. That's one thing that my students really struggle with when I teach these myths, is most of them are raised in a Christian tradition or a monotheistic tradition where they think of God as loving them. Well, Zeus didn't love anybody, and nobody in the Greek world would have expected him to.
That is really interesting. I thought about that a lot while I was reading the book, because when you think about modern theology, and, you know, let's take Christian theology, for example, God is a benevolent God. And particularly if you look at Jesus Christ, you know, here is someone that people try to live up to follow his example, because he is kind and wise and loving. And the Greek gods are none of those things. And yet the Greeks worshiped them and invented them. So, you know, it's thinking about, again, with Christian theology, you know, God created man in his own image, although there are people who say that man has returned that favor. But when you think about the Greeks inventing these gods that they then worshipped, it does seem to be really difficult to understand why the gods were so unkind and so violent.
It is. I mean, it's something I still struggle with after all these years of studying mythology. The Greeks believed in their gods, and they knew that the gods had certain powers over their lives, certain areas, like Hera, over a happy marriage. But they didn't love the gods, not really. They sacrificed to the gods. It was really much more of a business relationship than any sort of emotional or spiritual connection like most of us would think about today.
Well, and when you think about Zeus and, of course, all of the things that he did and all of the women that he raped and all of the children that he fathered and, you know, all of his infidelities and his violence, and then to look at Hera and all of the nasty things she's done to these young women, and then to think that there are these, you know, same young women, obviously different young women, but young women that could relate to the women in the stories, who are going to her temple and sacrificing on her altar because they want to have a happy marriage.
Sure, sure. It you know, for moderns like we said, it was a different world. The ancient Greek world was, they were not like us. So we really have to put ourselves back in a very, very different culture.
When you think about the stories about Zeus, and I wonder if this is because there were so many, and maybe there were so many similarities that you chose to tell them in this way, but when I look at the Zeus stories and then I compare them to the few stories that you were able to find about Hera, her stories seem so much more compelling and more detailed and more interesting. Is that because you had to compile so many Zeus stories, or did the goddesses tend to have a little bit more nuanced stories?
Well, I think the goddesses could be very mean and vindictive too, but their stories are I think a lot of them are more interesting. The sad thing is that most of these stories were written by men for a male audience, and so many of the women's myths we have lost forever. It's just so sad. And one thing I try to emphasize in the book are the women's stories that do survive. What they can tell us about the life of women in ancient Greece.
Well, let's talk about the men a little bit more, because we've talked a little bit about Zeus. Poseidon was very similar in that he would, again, cast an eye upon a young maiden, rape her, she would become pregnant, and then the story goes on from there. And the offspring of these unions have some of the best stories. These children that are born this way go on to lead extraordinary, sometimes horrible, but sometimes extraordinary lives in the stories. But Zeus also seemed to be very frustrated because Poseidon was very frustrated because he was not Zeus and he didn't have the power of Zeus. And he seemed to butt heads with the other gods a lot more. Would you say that's true?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Poseidon was the classic frustrated younger brother, or older brother, actually, in this case. But if it's possible to be meaner and nastier than Zeus in relations with mortal women, Poseidon was. And so he is always struggling with his brother and always treating women, including other gods, quite badly.
It strikes me as interesting as well when, you know, you think of the power of these gods, that they had to take all of these women by force. It seems to me that they could have done things in a much nicer way. But the stories about Apollo are really interesting because he is incredibly unlucky in love.
He is. Here's this young god shining and bright. And Apollo, for the most part, doesn't follow the example of his father and his uncle Poseidon. He actually tries to win the hearts of mortal women, and it doesn't work. He will promise them different gifts, like the young woman Sybil, who is a prophetess. He says, "I'll give you anything if you will only sleep with me, and I'll give you anything even if you won't sleep with me. Just ask." And she says, "Okay, I would like as many years of life as grains of sand I'm holding in my hand." And he says, "It's yours. Done. Now I'll give you immortality if you'll just sleep with me." And she says, "What do I need immortality for? I've got 1,000 years of life ahead of me."
It was a terrible mistake.
Oh, it was. I mean, it's one of the lessons about from mythology, be careful what you wish for, because Sybil had got 1,000 years of life, but she had forgotten to ask for eternal youth and for immortality. And so she goes on year after year, and eventually she becomes old and decrepit, and her arms and her legs shrivel up, and eventually she's just a speck, and the only thing left is her voice. And they put this little speck of a Sybil in a jar in a temple, and people for centuries, boys would come and say, "Sybil, what do you want?" And Sybil would whisper, "I want to die."
I'm talking with Philip Freeman. He's the author of the new book, Oh My Gods, A Modern Retelling of Greek and Roman Myths. And you're welcome to join our conversation. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Tony's on the line from Des Moines. Hi, Tony.
Yes, good morning. Professor Freeman, it sounds like a bit what you're describing is the ancient idea of the divine being a projection of human emotions, primarily male emotions, murderous rage, or perhaps passions, or the impulse to rape. But I wonder, what are we to make of parthenogenesis, the Artemises and the Athena, and I think Apollo also. Does the idea of parthenogenesis mark a difference in the relationship in the ancient mind between the human and the divine, the relationship between the two?
Well, it's really interesting.
And in parthenogenesis
is virgin birth.
Right.
The virgin birth, which of course is so prominent in Christian theology, is found in a number of places in Greek mythology. Athena, I think, is the great example. And it's a tough question. I would think, in a way, men like the idea that women are not really involved in them creating offspring, at least in this mythological world. And so I think it maybe is again a little bit of a wish projection. I'm not sure.
It is interesting. There are also there are stories that aren't quite parthenogenesis, but like, for example, when Dionysus was born,
yes,
if you want to call it that, it's kind of an interesting story of where Zeus actually took responsibility for his own actions, but he actually incubated the child.
Yes. Dionysus sleeps with a woman named Semele, and she gets pregnant,
but
of
Zeus
course.
Zeus sleeps with
I'm sorry. Zeus does, yes. And then Semele says, grant me a wish. And you know when that happens in mythology that something bad is about to happen. Semele says, I want to see you in all your glory.
And this is one of the rare women who actually...
That actually
willingly went with Zeus.
Absolutely. And so Zeus says, you don't want that. You really don't. And Semele says, yes, I do. And so Zeus had promised. And so he reveals himself, and Semele turns into into pieces. But Zeus takes the fetus out of Semele before that happens and puts it in his thigh, and then gives birth to Dionysus after that. Yes.
So a very, very interesting story. There's a lot of stories about sexuality, about male and female sexuality, and the idea of hermaphrodites, of course, comes from some of these ancient stories. And there seems to be a lot of toying with the idea of sexuality in these myths.
Oh, my goodness, yes. I mean, you can hardly find a myth that doesn't have some sort of fruit for psychologists and psychiatrists to dig into. Of course, Freud was very influenced by Greek mythology, and Jung and others as well. So if you are interested in sexual issues and all their various manifestations, Greek mythology is for you.
Well, and there's even a story that settles the age-old question of whether men or women enjoy sex more.
Yes, there is. Zeus and Hera get in an argument one time about whether men or women enjoy sex more. And of course, they both claim that it's the other, it's women who enjoy sex, or no, it's men. And so they go to a guy named Tiresias, who was a prophet, who had been, for a while, had been a woman because of another story. And so they say, Tiresias, who enjoys sex more, men or women? And Tiresias says, well, it's actually women.
And Hera is very angry.
And Hera is very angry after
but
that.
But
yes.
She always is.
She strikes him blind, yes.
John is on the line from Davenport. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Dr. Freeman, I'm interested in your opinion of Robert Graves' two-volume Greek mythology, and particularly the footnotes where he describes historical references that the mythologies refer to.
Yes, it's interesting. I mean, so many myths seem to have a historical point that they go back to. The classic one is Atlantis, which goes back to a passage in Plato. It's an idea that's very old in interpreting mythology, that these stories actually go back to some previous time. Let's say there was a time when there was a king named Zeus who had a bunch of children named Apollo and Artemis and the rest, and ruled over a kingdom. And eventually these stories turned into this reality, this history turned into stories. And sometimes that does happen. We know from Near Eastern mythology that there was a king named Gilgamesh, and there was a great mythology that grew up around him. So I think Robert Graves and a lot of people are right that some, not all, myths do have a historical basis behind them.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for your call, John. Another one of the interesting things about these stories is that you will hear or read passages that you still hear people using today. I mean, there are phrases out of Greek mythology that have made it into our everyday conversation. So we hear echoes of these myths all the time as we talk. One of the phrases, if the fates allow.
Yes.
We don't say if fate allows. We say if the fates allow, which is a reference to the fates in ancient mythology. It's very interesting how these phrases continue.
Oh, absolutely. The fates, and I was watching Jon Stewart a few weeks ago, and they talked about a Sisyphean task. going back to Sisyphus, who's punished in Hades by having to push a boulder up a hill, and he gets it almost to the top, and it slides back down again, and he has to keep doing it over and over again and never succeeds. So there are tons of, I mean, if you want to be culturally literate, you really need to have a basic knowledge of Greek and Roman mythology.
Well, probably there are many of us who use these phrases without even knowing that we're referring to mythology.
Well, absolutely. Like the verb tantalize comes from a son of Zeus named Tantalus, who was punished again in Hades. Tantalus served up his son to the gods in a banquet, and the gods got very angry about this. Tantalus was sent to Hades, and he was chained hungry and thirsty in a pool where he couldn't quite reach the water to drink. And above him were grapes hanging there, and he couldn't quite reach them to eat. And so he was forever tantalized.
I want to talk more about love in these stories, because we have talked quite a lot about these gods, these men taking women by force. But love, of course, is a recurring theme over and over and over again. And we're going to have to take a break here, but we'll get back to that in a moment. We'll talk about the goddess of love, Aphrodite. We'll talk about her son, or perhaps her son, Cupid, in just a moment. My guest is Philip Freeman. He is head of the Classics Department at Luther College, and this is his most recent book that we've been talking about. It's called Oh My Gods, A Modern Retelling of Greek and Roman Myths, an opportunity to bring these stories from scholarship into everyday life, an opportunity for everyone to get to know the ancient gods once more. The number to call if you'd like to join our conversation is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about Greek mythology. We're talking about the gods and goddesses on Mount Olympus and in the underworld. We're talking about it's hard to say the true stories, but the original stories of these gods and goddesses. My guest today is Philip Freeman. He's the head of the Classics Department at Luther College. His latest book is called Oh My Gods, A Modern Retelling of Greek and Roman Myths. And let's talk about love. Of course, Aphrodite was the goddess of love. We all know about Aphrodite, or Venus, as the Romans called her. And one would think that if somebody was going to get things right in the world of love, it would be Aphrodite. And yet she had an incredibly unhappy marriage.
She did. She was married to a god, Hephaestus, who was crippled because of Zeus, actually, who threw him off of Mount Olympus. So Aphrodite did have a very unhappy marriage, and she was the goddess of love, but I mean more accurately, she was the goddess of Eros, which I think a better translation would be sex. But she did care about love, and she did care about relationships as well.
And Hephaestus is an unhappy husband, clearly, as Aphrodite is quite unfaithful to him and spends a lot of time catching her in her infidelities.
Yes.
So many interesting stories along those lines. But tell me about Cupid. Where does Cupid come from?
Well, Cupid, or sometimes he's called Eros, he is the child of Aphrodite, probably. It's a little bit confusing, but Cupid is the messenger boy for Aphrodite, and so when she wants somebody to fall in love or not fall in love, she sends Cupid off to shoot his arrows into their heart.
It's so interesting. Aphrodite, Athena, they both have children with mortals or outside of wedlock, but they don't tend to raise their own children.
Well, Athena doesn't. Actually, Athena's a virgin goddess.
Okay, sorry.
But Aphrodite certainly does. And the goddesses are not particularly good mothers. They tend to make somebody else raise their children, or their children raise themselves, sort of on the streets of Mount Olympus, by themselves.
But they're all born quite precocious.
Yes. So. Oh, they are.
But Cupid has an interesting story, and this is one of the rare love stories in these myths that actually has a happy ending in the end. Tell me about Psyche.
Psyche was a absolutely gorgeous young woman who lived in a town in ancient Greece, and she was so beautiful that people stopped making sacrifices at the temple of Aphrodite. When they saw Psyche walking by, they said, why should we sacrifice to some goddess far away when Psyche is right here? And so Aphrodite got really mad, and she sent Cupid down to destroy Psyche's life. But Cupid fell in love with her. And so he whisked her off to a castle, and she lay there at night, and she didn't know what was going on or who was coming in because it was always dark. And this man lay down and made love with her, and he said, my dear, you are welcome to stay here and to be a queen, but you can never see my face. And so she began to worry, and her sisters began to worry, and they say, this is just a monster who's just waiting for you to get
and
really pregnant.
And her sisters were very jealous.
Oh, her sisters
were
mean. This is a Cinderella story, if there ever was one. And so her sisters say, you know, you've got to find out what he looks like. And so Psyche takes a candle and lights it and looks at the face of Cupid, and he's not a monster at all, but a beautiful god. And then she gets kicked out, and Aphrodite makes her go through all these horrible tasks. And
Wait, about Cinderella story. I mean, some of the very same tasks that Cinderella later had to do in separating the lentils from the stones, that kind of thing.
Yes, very much. I mean, this was an influential story for the Middle Ages and beyond. And so Psyche is always threatening to throw herself off of some tower or something. but then somebody will come along and help her to solve this problem. And eventually it does work out. She and Cupid get together and they have a child named Happiness.
We have a call on the line from Harry in Iowa City. Hi, Harry.
Hi. Hi, Professor. I think this book is awesome. I'm very interested to get it. I remember when I was taking Greek mythology in college, it was a real eye-popping experience to see what a role homosexuality had in the expression of human emotion and how routine it was. It simply wasn't an issue in the way that we perceived it in the 70s and still do to some extent.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say absolutely.
I like your comment on it. It just blew my mind.
Sure. We talked about Zeus and his female lovers, but he had male lovers too, and so did Poseidon, so did Apollo.
Well, and last time you were on the show, we were talking about Alexander the Great. And this was just a regular part of Greek society.
Sure.
Among the gods and among the mortals
as
well. Sure.
I mean, in historical Greek society, it varied according to time and place, but they would not have thought about sexual orientation in the same way we do. Somebody was heterosexual, homosexual, even bisexual, they just wouldn't have thought in those terms. And so you get all sorts of different manifestations and variations of sexual relationships in ancient Greece.
Well, and it is interesting when you talk about Zeus and Poseidon and Apollo, they all had male lovers, and these tend to be much happier relationships than their relationships with any of the women they encounter.
Which I think is a reflection of what, at least you read Plato and the rest, and the philosophers, ancient Greek philosophers, and they talk about the highest form of human love is between men and not between, you know, between you have to get married, you have to have children, that's a duty, and sometimes it can be a happy duty. But if you want true friendship, find another man.
The love stories that are included in all of these myths, I mean, we just talked about Cupid and Psyche, which is a happy story. They quite literally a happy story as they produce happiness together. Most of the love stories that you tell in this book are not happy stories. And you talk about the fact that so many people have been inspired over the years by these stories. We talked about Cinderella, but Shakespeare, for example, and there are a number of different role models for Romeo and Juliet in these stories.
Sure. There's a great story of Pyramus and Thisbe, who are these two young people deeply in love, live next to each other in ancient Babylon, but their families hate each other. And so they can only talk through this little crack in the wall. And so they arrange to have a meeting one night. And so Thisbe sneaks out into this appointed place outside of the city. And she sees a lion there who's just killed a lamb and so has the bloody jaws. And she drops her cloak and then runs away. And then the lion comes up and chews on Thisbe's cloak for a while. And then Pyramus shows up and sees this cloak with blood all over it and lion prints all over the place. And he says, oh, no, the lion has killed my love. And so he stabs himself. And then Thisbe comes back and finds Pyramus there dying, and so she stabs herself. And so we, of course, have the setting for Romeo and Juliet.
Absolutely. We have an email from Brianne in Ames. She says, I've been reading about goat husbandry, and I've learned that actually when a buck in heat, his behavior is not too far from those of the god Pan. Can you talk about Pan a little bit?
Sure. Pan was a very goaty god, certainly. He was a child of Hermes, and he was always wandering around in the woods, and he was a god of shepherds, and he did like to hang out in the woods. And so if you ever go out in the woods at night by yourself and it's dark and you hear a sound, you might think it's Pan, which of course is where we get our word panic from.
And Pan, as you mentioned, a very goaty god, and he did seem to be driven by lust.
Oh, yes. Much more basic and much more lovable in a lot of ways than some of the other gods, but absolutely a lust-driven god.
He was also one of the rare gods who wasn't entirely in human form.
Yes. He looked very much, he had a lot of goat features. He was sort of a hybrid goat, which is just a reflection of the goaty nature. We think of goats as being very sexual, and so they made Pan look like that.
Well, I mentioned that Shakespeare was obviously influenced by ancient myths, but also many other writers and artists have been influenced, and many writing today. You mention in the book J.K. Rowling, and of course, if you think about some of the names that show up in the Harry Potter series, Sirius, Hermione,
absolutely,
you know, these come directly from these myths, and we see it a lot. Among the things that you see out in pop culture right now that draw on mythology, what do you like?
Well, I like Rowling's books. I think she had a really good classical education, and so I use her magic spells, which are based on Latin anyway. I use those in my classes, and she works mythology, I think, very well into the Harry Potter stories. But there are so many instances of mythology. Back in the 70s, there were a lot of car names. Actually, there still are. The Volkswagen, was it the Phaeton or Phaeton, which is kind of a silly name to give a car because Phaeton was killed by Zeus and crashed. But there are just so many influences in Greek mythology still today. And you cannot go to the local Metroplex and Cineplex and see a movie without at least one Greek mythology movie being there. Immortals, Wrath of the Titans, things like that.
Well, and there's a series of books out about Percy Jackson, who is a son of a god, son of Poseidon,
right,
as we discover in the books, that really digs into this mythology and pulls on a lot of these ancient stories, not just the ones that everybody seems to know, but a lot of the less well-known ones as well.
Right. The author of the Percy Jackson series has done his homework and did a very good job creating. And, of course, he doesn't just simply tell the stories. He reworks them. But he did a very good job. So if you'd like an introduction, if your children would like a good introduction to Greek mythology, the Percy Jackson books are a very good choice.
And they're not all just whitewashed, although maybe not quite as stark as the ones we've been talking about today. Let's talk a little bit about Rome, because, of course, we all know that these gods were translated into Roman culture as well, but they were basically the same gods.
They basically were. The Romans had their own gods, but they were more sort of basic forces of nature. A lot of them didn't even have bodies or weren't thought of as having bodies. So they adopted a lot of the different Greek gods and worked them into their own mythology. They changed the names. Zeus became Jupiter. Hera became Juno, things like that. But they had some of their own mythology. We get the story of Romulus and Remus in the founding of Rome, the story of Aeneas. The Roman mythology is really interesting because it is very different from the Greek mythology. It's much more of a stark, almost Stalinist sort of propaganda for the state. So it's fascinating to look at.
Well, tell us the story of Lucretia briefly.
Lucretia was a young wife who was married to a Roman soldier, and this Roman soldier's best friend was the son of the local king. And so one time these two friends are out in the field at war, and they're having an argument about who has the best wife. And so they sneak back into town, and the son of the king, his wife is out at a party, drinking wine, having a good time, and they go to the house of Lucretia, and she's there working late by candlelight, weaving and spinning and supervising her slaves, just like a good Roman maid. matron should do. Well, the Roman the prince is smitten with Lucretia and sneaks back to her home a few nights later and says that he wants to sleep with her. And of course, she says, "No, I won't do it." And so he tricks her and forces her into it. And then when it happens, she calls her husband and her family in, and she explains exactly what this young man did. And then she stabs herself. So she kills herself, even though she was the victim of the crime.
But the story of Lucretia has consequences far beyond a family squabble.
Yes, absolutely. The prince and his father are overthrown. Rome becomes a republic, and happiness descends on the village by the Tiber River after that.
So this was the end of monarchy in the Roman world.
It was the end of monarchy, absolutely.
So definitely something that we can see influence in our society today. And of course, we when you think about politics, you can go back to a lot of the principles of ancient Greek and Roman politics. But other than that, why do you think that people need to understand these stories? What can we learn from them that we can bring to our lives today?
Well, that's the best thing about the reason that so many children love these stories and why the classes in classical mythology across the nation are always full. Sure, they're great stories, but they're stories that teach you something about how to live your own life. You read the story of Odysseus trying desperately to get home to Penelope, his wife, and you learn that love really is the best thing of all. We talked about Sybil and learning about be careful what you wish for. But there are so many powerful lessons in Greek mythology, some of them quite unhappy, but still powerful nonetheless, that people can learn and apply to their own lives.
We have so much literature, though, and of course you can learn so much from fiction of all forms. Why are these stories still so fascinating? What gives them a staying power that maybe our other kinds of literature that have arisen throughout the years don't have?
Well, I think it's because the Greeks were geniuses, and they were able to tap into the heart, the core of human emotion, like few people have been able to, maybe Shakespeare aside, have been able to since in the last 2,000 or 3,000 years. So I think that they just were able to look and to really touch what matters to us most.
When you were researching this book, of course, you've spent many years telling these stories, learning these stories. In your research, what did you learn that was new to you?
Oh, the variations of these stories. I knew that there were varieties to them, but it's fascinating to look, and this is what I do in my classes, is look at the different versions, the first ones that happen in Homer and Hesiod, and then see how that develops later in Greece, and then how that develops in Rome. It's absolutely fascinating. I learned so much about the different little bitty variants in these stories that really, I think, the differences can tell you a lot.
You mentioned that you spent a little extra time with some of the stories about the goddesses because these are the stories that don't get told as often. Do you think that there are stories yet to be discovered about these goddesses, or do you think that they're lost?
Well, probably most of them are lost forever, unfortunately. But they are always digging up papyrus in the sands of Egypt, and almost every year somebody discovers something. It's usually not as fantastic as a whole new story, but sometimes that does happen, or a new variant of a story, or a new poem or something like that. So there are new myths waiting to be discovered, absolutely.
In discovering these stories and rewriting them yourself, did you develop any new favorites? Are there gods and goddesses that really resonate with you now?
Well, I tell you, the gods and goddesses, not so much. But some of the mortals, yes. I've always loved the story of Odysseus and the Odyssey. And after doing this, I appreciate it even more. It is an absolute masterpiece, if not the best story ever told. So yes, go out and buy a copy of the Odyssey even before you buy this book of mine, and read it. It's just wonderful.
Philip, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Philip Freeman, his latest book is Oh My Gods, a Modern Retelling of Greek and Roman Myths. He is the head of the Classics Department at Luther College in Decorah. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Alex Hoyer. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Emily Woodbury. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow at this time, a program being recorded in conjunction with Minnesota Public Radio previewing the Iowa caucuses. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.
Heart for me. Now, I don't mean to bother you, but I'm in distress. There's danger of